We're at the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with Jeffrey West. Jeffrey's a distinguished professor here, and since 2005 has actually been president of the Santa Fe Institute. This, probably with great relief, is his last week, and he'll be replaced August the 1st by Jeremy Sabloff. But this is also the 25th anniversary year of the Santa Fe Institute, so probably a bittersweet moment for you, but I'd like to get some sense from you of what the Santa Fe Institute means to you, why you came here, what it stands for, and where you think it's going.
Sure. Yes, well, let me start on a personal note. Indeed, it is my last week as president, and I will be returning, I guess is what it is, to what I actually came here to do, which is spend my full time on my research activities. And that's been a source of great frustration to me in the last few years that I've, needless to say, had to spend only a minority of my time doing my research. Nevertheless, it's been an extraordinary experience because in many ways I consider myself blessed, and as president honored, but blessed at the end of my career to actually in some ways find the place I was always looking for. Namely, when I entered academia, I had kind of a naive, romantic image that maybe a university would be a community of scholars, that, there'd be lots of time to sit around and discuss some of the big questions, kind of very kind of high school sophomoric view of what a university is. And maybe universities were once like that. Maybe they never were. I don't know. That's certainly my image of traditional universities in the sort of 19th century and so on. But this place really has, was set up, in fact, to be a community of scholars and to attract people that were interested in some of the bigger questions, and in particular those that cross the canonical disciplinary boundaries, and very much a self-selected group of people, those that, whether they be students, postdocs, or Nobel Prize winners, for various reasons felt frustrated or dissatisfied by the kind of stovepiping that certainly now exists even more than it did. But even when this place was founded in the early 80s, had already developed in academia, namely that the whole reward system, the whole structure, was forcing more and more researchers to become highly focused, not just to be disciplinary, but that within the discipline to be the expert in X or Y and so on. And we're all very familiar with that. And now the situation is even worse in many ways because we speak of disciplines, but we're all familiar with the fact that if you go into a physics department or a biology department or an economics department, in fact, the department itself is stovepiped so that there are groups and structures which are themselves semi-autonomous within that departmental structure. So it becomes extremely difficult in terms of the reward system for researchers who want to, expand their vision and their ambition to think more broadly, find themselves frustrated. And the Institute was set up approximately 25 years ago, certainly in the thinking was in the early 80s and through the 80s, that by this small group of very distinguished scientists, three of them had Nobel Prizes, and real Nobel Prizes, capital N, capital P. These are big conceptual thinkers like Murray Gell-Mann, Phil Anderson, and so on, Ken Arrow, who themselves were somehow frustrated that there wasn't a place that was encouraging of this bigger version, that is, a physicist thinking about economics or a physicist thinking about language or an economist starting to think a little more like a physicist. And beginning with that core, there was this idea that there should be one institution on the academic landscape that was the exact complement to the traditional university. There'd be no departments. It would simply be this self-selected group of scholars, whether they be archaeologists or anthropologists or mathematical physicists doing string theory, if that were the case, bringing them together in one place. And somehow this kind of idea, which has a certain naivete to it, that if you bring together scholars, outstanding people at all levels of career, and just bring them together and facilitate their interaction, great things will happen. That was kind of the model. And to some extent, I think the impact of the Institute over those 25-odd years is really testament to the fact that that can work. I think it's probably true that I can't speak for those original founding fathers, but certainly I'll speak for myself that I think the Institute has been an enormous success. But one of the things that really has to be clear is that, and I'll speak here personally, that I believe quite strongly, actually, in the conventional structure of universities. Actually, I do believe that this model, which presumably comes out of kind of the German university of the 19th century, where you do start salaming things up to some extent, actually has served us extraordinarily well and still does, because the very nature of much of research requires that kind of focus. What I consider the tragedy that evolved from that, so on the one hand, I believe 90-something percent should be that way. The tragedy has been that it turned out to be 100%. That's the problem, that it was 100%, and the vested interests have been very reluctant to allow the borders to be gray and porous. And we're seeing more and more, at least lip service given to that. And in fact, I would say that one of the metrics for the success of the Santa Fe Institute is that if you look on the web pages of any major distinguished university, any of the funding agencies, the major foundations, what you will see, and it's a bit of a cartoon version, you will see a whole bunch of hype and buzzwords saying, we want to break down the barriers between the disciplines, the major problems of the 21st century require cross-disciplinary, multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary, you choose your word, thinking. We're working on complex adaptive systems and so on. We could walk out of here and go down to my office and I can show you the kind of bullshit that I get from Stanford. I was there for many years, from the president saying basically that. Of course, it's not true. It is true that they may want to promote it, but it's not true that it actually happens. Nevertheless, it is a kind of a metric of the success of SFI. And if you look at where these ideas come from, they primarily can be traced back to the Santa Fe Institute. And, just an aside, that has been, there are people that have studied this and that make testimony to this, that it was the establishment of the Institute that has been a prime mover in this. So we're very proud of that. And and I must say, when I first came on board here, I used to say that I look forward to the day when there's no need for a Santa Fe Institute. Then, in fact, this will be integrated into the university. And I've sort of backed off a long way from that because what I see now is to do it in the way that we do it here, which is quite unique, is almost impossible, and maybe is impossible to do within a university setting. It's not that you couldn't have, and you do have, successful versions, but on a different scale within universities.
Groups,
centers. Actually, in a group sense, in a small sense, a center for, center for complex systems, center for environmental studies that tries to bring together lots of people together. No, these are, and many have been very successful, may I say. But to do the kinds of things that have been done here, where you have really what I consider serious transdisciplinary interaction, where it really is true that the anthropologist or archaeologist works with the physicist and the agent-based modeler and the economists trying to deal with problems of common interest occurs very rarely elsewhere in the kind of way it happens here. And so it is a kind of unique environment. And also, one last thing while I'm on it, is that another aspect of it in terms of what we promote. So we promote transdisciplinary kinds of interactions, collaborations, thinking, big questions, and so on. And out of that, of course, came this development of ideas about complex adaptive systems as being the kinds of problems that had somehow fallen between the cracks in university environment. But the other aspect that is unique about the Institute, which many people in academia don't recognize, is that in addition to the large academic network, broad academic network that we have of researchers, we also have a broad business network that interfaces very strongly with the Institute and plays a major role in the Institute, covering companies from, Google, Yahoo, and eBay to, John Deere and Boeing and Toyota to, Fidelity and other investment companies and so on. And these people were attracted, again, in a self-selected way to the Institute because they saw that a different way of thinking and approaching problems had developed here, and it would be very useful for them as a way of thinking about the kinds of problems they deal with in the business corporate community.
Yeah. Let me just read a couple of things to you, if I may, which bears on what you've just been saying. First of all, one of the founders of this place, you mentioned Murray Gell-Mann, wrote in the Time magazine, the 100 Most Influential People of 2006, he wrote your entry, which described you. And he said in there, again, science has never been a world of discrete disciplines.
Right.
Rather, physics, geology, economic psychology, even the arts all overlap in a kind of a meta system with the principles of one touching those of the others. Investor behavior can mimic that of schools of fish. Genealogical trees for languages can resemble those for species. Mathematics can drive music. Then he mentioned that you had written on a number of subjects, and I look at your bio and see that you're originally a theoretical physicist whose primary interests have been in fundamental questions in physics, elementary particles, and so on. And then I, just as an exercise, pulled your last, most recent papers from one journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The last one, A General Quantitative Theory of Forest Structure and Dynamics. The one before that, A Quantitative Theoretical Framework for Understanding Mammalian Sleep. The Rate of DNA Evolution, Effects of Body Size and Temperature on the Molecular Clock. Growth, Innovation, Scaling, and the Pace of Life in Cities. Scaling of Number, Size, and Metabolic Rate of Cells with Body Size in Mammals. And then Allometric Scaling of Metabolic Rate. The word scaling is turning up here, and is that the link that puts together this sleep and cities and aging? Yeah. Is another paper we have here. Explain what the theoretical underpinnings of all this.
Okay. Yes, I don't know why I feel slightly embarrassed by that list because another reaction to that is that, there's a dilettante just prancing around from one, So let me see if I can bring all this together. So indeed, I spent most of my career doing high-energy physics, elementary particle physics, trying to investigate fundamental laws, what are the elementary particles, and some of those kind of big questions of physics.
Originally where, by the way?
Well, I was at Stanford for a number of years, and then I was... And what brought me to New Mexico was the opportunity to set up what turned out to be a wonderful group at Los Alamos in theoretical physics. That was a very eclectic group, but focused on high-energy physics. And that's what brought me actually ultimately in contact with the Santa Fe Institute.
Now, a lot of those were biological and...
Those were. So I'll tell you. So What happened was, it's kind of a curious story, but about, I've always had very broad interests, but beginning approximately 10 years ago, I became two things, the coincidence of two things in my life. One was I had been involved with efforts at the superconducting supercollider. So you may recall this was this $10, $12 billion project about a huge collider in Texas that was going to reveal all these wonderful things about elementary particles, supersymmetry, maybe other dimensions, and all kinds of wonders. And that thing was canned in the early Clinton administration and in the early 90s, basically. So I was involved in that, and this was a kind of crisis in the field. And at the same time, so I was in my early mid-50s, and I also became quite interested in my own biology, namely the fact that I was aging. I was getting old, and I was kind of intrigued by it. And the coincidence of the events were that I was getting intrigued by my own aging at a personal level, and at the same time, with the demise of the SSC and a kind of crisis in high-energy physics, that was also summarized by the kind of statement that you'll be familiar with that we heard, which was, you know, physics was the science of the 19th and 20th centuries, yeah. Biology will be the science of the 21st century, okay? But the corollary is what I heard as well was, therefore, physics is finished. And that seemed to me nuts. Sure, physics was a mature subject, but it had very exciting prospects nevertheless. But more importantly, it seemed to me that if biology, and this was my arrogant view, was that if biology were to become a real science, and that is with a capital S, as distinct from a lowercase s, and I take that incidentally from Darcy Thompson, who distinguished this,
who wrote on growth and form,
the famous book at the beginning of the 20th century. If biology were to become a mature science, it would have to embrace the paradigms and the thinking, possibly even some of the techniques of physics. It would have to become more mathematizable, more quantitative, and so on. Incidentally, that's what Darcy Thompson said 100 years earlier, basically. Now, I did this out of ignorance, frankly. Nevertheless, it started me thinking, this coincidence of all these things started me thinking, and I thought, you know, if biology were a science with a capital S, we would understand why it is that I'm aging, why it is that, you know, my skin is getting lined and I'm going gray, and I feel more weary than I used to. And more importantly, I'm going to be dead within the next, I was in my 50s, certainly within the next 50 years, I will be dead. So it occurred to me that if biology were a science in the sense I was thinking, it would not only have a theory, a mechanistic theory of aging, but as part of that theory, you would predict, you would have a calculation of 100 years if you're a human being, and you would relate that to the microscopic scales of the genome, which are molecular timescales. So how in the hell do molecular timescales suddenly become 100 years if you have a multicellular organism? And why is it that if this piece of tissue that happens to be me, it happened to have been a mouse, it would have been dead when it was 2 or 3 years old? So that would be a theory to me. You know, that would be somehow a conclusive part of a theory. So I started thinking about that, actually. And in thinking about that way of viewing biology, I started to get interested in scaling laws, because I realized this thing between a mouse and a human being is the same stuff, but it's behaving differently over different scales. Got me interested in scaling. And some of my work in high-energy physics have been involved in scaling phenomena in a much different way, nevertheless in a scaling phenomenon. And indeed, you know, if you think of the expansion of the universe following Einstein's theory of general relativity, the expansion of the universe is a scaling phenomenon. The universe is continually growing bigger, and therefore everything is scaling. And indeed, in the modern parlance, using fancy language of something called the renormalization group, we understand why it is that the forces of nature, which are, you know, there are only four fundamental forces of nature, why they behave differently at different scales. And this is very powerful, and is in fact that aspect of high energy physics is one of the truly great achievements in science. So I wanted to take some of these ideas into biology, and so I started searching the literature, and I discovered something extraordinary, that indeed in biology there are these remarkable scaling laws. And they're remarkable because they're so simple. So my view was, it seemed to me there was an extraordinary mystery and paradox here. Namely, life is the most diverse and complex system probably in the universe. And each organism, each subsystem of an organism, each cell type, each component of a cell has evolved in its own unique environmental niche with an extraordinary historical contingency. That's what natural selection is about. Each one is unique and each one has interacted in a continuous feedback mechanism with its endogenous and exogenous environments. And out of that, all of this has developed. It's, you know. And so what you would expect is if you looked at any trait, say, or any fundamental quantity, and the one that is most famous is something like metabolic rate, how much energy is needed per second to keep an organism alive, and you plotted that versus size, you would see all over the map. You wouldn't see any real trend because its metabolic rate would be representative, presumably, of its evolutionary history. Nevertheless, what you see is quite the contrary. You see an extraordinary systematic scaling, and that scaling is represented by a very simple law that was discovered many, many years ago by a name named Max Kleiber, which is that metabolic rate scales in this ridiculously simple way, very approximately as mass to the 3/4 power. And that is very interesting. He discovered it for mammals and birds, but it turns out it's true for almost any taxonomic group, fish, insects, and so on. And we've even taken it down to intracellular levels. But even more compelling is the fact that you look at any trait. You look at mundane things like, you know, lengths of aortas. You look at sophisticated things like lifespan and growth rates. You look at diffusion rates of oxygen across cells. You look at cell size and so on. Tens of these, 50 to 75 of these. They all have this kind of characteristic. And amazingly, they all have exponents that corresponds to the 3/4 of metabolic rate that are simple multiples of 1/4. And that's very compelling, because it says that something else is going on here. This must be something else that's constraining all these things that should have much more randomness, much more fluctuations, somehow are being compelled to have much more systematic behavior. And so that's what I got interested in as a problem to work on. But it was driven but to try to understand why it is I'm going to be dead before I'm age 100.
This paper on scaling of number size and metabolic rate of cells with body size, which is what you've just been talking about. How does that translate? This is obviously full of mathematics and so on. How does that translate into practical terms? You're basically saying that the clock is running in different groups, taxa, different at a rate that nevertheless is
had some systematic behavior. Yes. So one of the things that, so let me just go a little bit to the theoretical structure that was developed. And that was, and then I'll come and answer that question. So the first thing that you realize when you think about this is that, my God, you know, these scaling laws seem to be so ubiquitous, and not only do they cover an extraordinary range, I mean, they actually cover something like 27 orders of magnitude in mass, which is just unbelievable, actually. But they cover all kinds of evolved designs. So whatever is controlling this has to be independent of scale, obviously, but most importantly, has to be independent of design, of evolved design, the engineered design that has evolved, whether it be a mammal, a fish, bird, a cell, and so on.
Let me just interrupt and ask you a quick question. In other words, if you got hold of some critter, a fish or a mouse or whatever, and measured its metabolic rate, then you could infer reliably how long it was going to live.
For example. Well, yes. So put it slightly differently, that what you learn from this is, if you tell me the size, and in particular, and in more detail, the taxonomic group, you tell me it's a mammal, and you tell me how much it weighs, I can tell you an extraordinary amount about its physiology. I can tell you an extraordinary amount about its life history, meaning its size at birth, its how long it takes to grow to maturity, how long it will live, and so on. Roughly, this is what we call a coarse-grained description. This is not, you know, Newton's laws giving rise to detailed description of any process to any arbitrary degree of accuracy, but this is a coarse-grained description, an order of magnitude, in the same sense that I talked about before, that to understand why it is our lifespan is 100 years and a mouse's is 2 to 3 years, or why it is that, if we wanted to be more detailed, the rate of diffusion of oxygen across the walls of a capillary is whatever it is, you can determine that from this. So there's a whole bunch of things, a myriad aspects of an organism that this theoretical structure can predict and determine. And the structure that the theory is actually the observation that underlying the sustainability of all life on networks. And it is these, so for example, think about yourself. You are, from this viewpoint, you are nothing more than a circulatory system, a respiratory system, a renal system, a neural system, a bunch of bones, and so on. But at all scales you are. If you go inside your cells, there are networks. If you go inside mitochondria, there are networks. And so the idea was that these scaling laws are actually manifestations of the generic, universal, mathematizable properties of these networks, and that these have universal properties. So this mathematical structure that was set up was to postulate some very generic properties. I mean, I'll give you one that's very simple. One is that these networks have to be what we call space-filling. They have to go everywhere. So, for example, your circulatory system better have evolved so that the capillaries, the endpoints of the network, feed all of the cells of your body. They need to be, you know, serviced. And so that's called space filling. They go everywhere. So you have to put that into a mathematical language. So there's a few of such very general, I'll use the word, and even though it's a bit pretentious, universal properties of these networks. And the idea is that you have to put those into a mathematical language and then look at the properties that result when you look at specific systems like your circulatory system or your respiratory system or potentially your neural system. And out of that came all these scaling laws. But on top of it came a quantitative description of the networks themselves. So, as an example, if you perversely were interested in knowing what is the length, radius, blood flow rate, pulse rate, stress on the walls of the ninth branch of a hippopotamus's circuitry system. There is a formula sitting, you know, out of my office down there, which you can plug in the numbers. And for the average hippopotamus, it is claimed you will get the right answer. Now, we have done this for rats, mice, dogs, cats, and human beings, and you do get the right answer for the on the average. And so it is an average, the theory should be thought of as an average idealized coarse-grained description of some of the generic features of organisms.
Now, somebody might say, what would be the utility of this?
Yes, so now let's come back to this. Yeah, so, well, there are, first of all, of course...
Not that it needs to have any, but...
No, exactly. That was my first response. You know, science, of course, I mean, one of the great miracles to me, one of the truly great miracles, I think, about the human endeavor is that people not having to have a reason other than their own curiosity to start looking at such questions, whatever they may be, and deriving theoretical structures has led to the technological society we live in. That's why we have the standard of living we have, is that the spin-offs from those and the kind of mindset and ways of thinking about things, which and the spillover from that way of thinking to applied science and to technology is one of the great miracles. And it always astounds me still that scientists have to go and justify themselves to Congress and other funders because it's kind of a no-brainer. The investment is tiny compared to the payoff. Anyway, that's a
but back
subject. Let's go to the crass level of, yeah, what are they? And I think that's nevertheless, clearly, you know, to get back to reality, so to speak, if you get funded, you have to justify at some level your existence, and some of those payoffs may take 50 years, in which case it's very hard to justify. Nevertheless, some have a very short-term payoff. So let's go to this kind of work. So I think that the kinds of problems that we have investigated from this, so you mentioned one there, recent paper on forests. So this was a bunch of work that developed a theory. The original paper was to develop a theory of how plants work, plants, trees work, in terms of, you know, if you want to know how much energy is flowing through each branch, how many leaves would the tree have, what are the various sizes and distributions and so on. So that was extended to forests and ecosystems so that one understood the structure of an ecosystem. And potentially, this has potentially important applications to understanding the sustainability of forests, mm-hmm. to even potentially to problems of carbon sequestration, potentially to problems of damage and perturbations. Big forest fires, what's going to happen to that? Mm-hmm. You know, can we, how does it recover, and so on. Now, that's, let me hasten to add, the work that I am involved with and my colleagues, we've done a little bit of that, but rarely address those questions. We're interested in the basic science, but we hope that people will use these as people in forestry and people think about some of these questions, these more immediate practical questions, will use that. So in the same way that recent work that is not yet published that we have worked on is developing a theory, an understanding, a quantitative, mathematizable, quantitative, predictive, mathematizable theory of tumors, and in particular of tumors from this sense of their vasculature, something called angiogenesis, to understand what is the nature of the networks that develop in tumors. How does their metabolic rate, how does the amount of necrosis, the amount of dead tissue in tumors depend upon the size of the tumor and the size of the host? Mm-hmm. There you have a very interesting, challenging question, because all of the experiments that are done on tumors are done on mice and rats. And the question is, how do you scale those up? So one of the fundamental questions that one needs to ask is, how many tumors should a mouse have? I mean, one of the things that's been observed, mice, and you, and most people know it anecdotally, dogs get many more tumors than human beings. But so you might naively conclude, first of all, well, gee whiz, maybe we shouldn't be working on those model systems. You know, they're not the right systems to be working on because they have so many more tumors than we do. But much better is to try to understand the scaling of that and say, yes, and in fact, I think it's true, mice have the right number of tumors they should have for that size of animal. So that's the kind of framework that one tries to develop for these kinds of things in attacking many of these problems. So first of all, it's to understand in a big picture the way life biology works, and then address some of the questions that potentially might have biomedical application.